Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the IRIS Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. Copyright 2005 by Hannah Holmes and published by Bloomsbury Publishing, New York, New York. In the last episode, the author was visiting the Lancaster brothers in Phoenix, Arizona to see how they conserve water. We resume Suburban Safari on page 129, and this is episode 13. With water in place, the brothers planted their plants, large and small. Brad now consults for others who want to harvest rain and grow native plants. His underlying motivation seems to be a love for the desert surrounding Tucson. Here, and in clients' yards, he reintroduces native vegetation. He's extra fond of plants that produce food. The Sonoran Desert, he says, offers 375 such plants, or that have a medicinal use. He nibbles as he introduces me to his plants and plucks things for me to chew. It's a living almanac, he says of his yard. When I see my cholla, C-H-O-L-L-A, blossoming, I know I've got to get out and harvest them from around the city. When I see my prickly pears fruiting, I know they're fruiting out in the desert. Is this a prickly pear? I ask as we pass the beehives and the chicken coop. And what's wrong with it? The thing is wrinkled and droopy. Brad looks a little surprised. That's what the plant does naturally in the dry season, he says. We get enough rain in Tucson to take care of a native plant yard like this, but people still water because they don't like it when a plant doesn't look good, even though that's the plant's natural adaptation. But aesthetics should be no impediment to converting Bermuda grass to prickly pears, Brad insists. That's where gray water comes in. The wastewater from our lives is enough to grow a jungle. The Lancasters like to say they consume their dirty laundry water in the form of peaches and sour oranges. Brad sighs. That tree does suck up water, but the leaves are so good in Thai food. Outside the fence again, I start to appreciate how wide this yard's circle of influence extends. Rod, dark hair and reserved, is no less zealous than his brother. The brothers have wildified the unpaved sidewalk with more cacti and trees, making a shady path for pedestrians. Neighbors have begun to add native plants to their own yards. Birds are carrying native seeds from the Lancasters' yard to more distant yards. A few blocks west, the brothers led an effort to convert a parking lot to a community garden. Every year they organize a native foods festival to introduce people to the Sonoran Desert's abundance. They've spearheaded tree planting campaigns. Brad is currently prodding the city to let people cut their curbs the way he has to capture street water, and so on. I ask Brad what he would take as a sign of success, an indication that Tucson's yards were functioning as a desert ecosystem. He ponders, a solemn young man with the fate of the planet on his mind. In the neighborhood, I'd like to see quail come back. That would tell me there's good cover to protect them from cats. And you know, my parents used to see javelina, bobcats, mountain lions, mule deer, and white-tailed deer around their house. Those things belong here. We did actually have a javelina come through the neighborhood once, and since we planted our own yard, we've got cactus wrens, curved-billed thrashers, flycatchers. They eat our honeybees, geckos, lizards, the chickens eat them, horned toads, the chickens are a little hard on them too, butterflies, sphinx moths, beneficial wasps. He thinks a bit more. If I saw willows, cottonwoods, and Mexican elderberries starting to volunteer, then we've done it. They used to be all along the river and the floodplain. People would get lost in them. Right now, we're desertifying this area and making it a more arid ecosystem. But if those trees could make it, that would indicate that the water table was up to where it used to be. The same with native grasses. The wind is picking up, carrying the scent of hot rain. Brad has a meeting to go to, and he climbs on a bicycle. I head off to the mall for a fresh tube of sunblock. As I park, thunder cracks. Golf balls of water splat on my windshield. As I cross the parking lot, waves of water sluice over the asphalt. Under the store's awning, people shift excitedly. They look at their cars, then up at the lightning and water balls. "Wet T-shirt contest!" one woman shrieks and sprints for her car. The others laugh and shuffle their feet. Another woman says, "We don't know what to do in the rain." At the edge of the lot, the rushing water sloshes against an asphalt island planted with emerald turf and shrubs from Asia. The water bounces off the island and flows away down a drain. Fall. Chapter 7. Before. My neighborhood and its beach are named after Captain Benjamin Willard. In a portrait, the man stands solemn-faced. His mustache is elaborately curled. His tights pouch at the knee. The fringe on his shorts tickles his thigh. A spotted dog, also solemn, sits like a hat on Willard's head. The captain's 1895 autobiography includes tales of sharks and swordfish he caught. It recounts shipwrecks, Civil War skirmishes, and other acts of daring do. But the chapter in which Willard's gentle soul shines, the chapter most heavily illustrated with drawings and early photographs, is the one titled My Trained Pets, The Coach Dog and the Cedar Bird. The chapter opens with a drawing of the big man lying on his back on the parlor floor, one leg extended toward the ceiling. Balancing on Willard's foot is, again, the Dalmatian. One can view the history of a place through any filter one chooses. Why not through dogs? There's the poster pups of the modern backyard, and prehistoric dire wolves, foxes, and other canines probably inhabited my yard before people did. Then, when the first people walked in 12,000 years ago, a domesticated canine came with them. Most of the local canids fell into extinction. Most recently, Europeans sailed in 400 years ago with a fresh batch of dog stock. Once again, most of the resident dogs faded in the face of today's dominant strains. Dog replaced dog replaced dog. One of the wildest chapters in this doggy history is unfolding right now as coyotes and wolves soft foot back toward my suburban lawn. These days, the dominant canine sleeps indoors, and from among the odors of shampoo and coffee, he can't detect the scent of his approaching cousins. Cousin Coyote, whom wolves once kept penned in the West, has lately trotted as far east as Nova Scotia. Like crows, the coyotes are finding the suburbs a safe and agreeable habitat. Cousin Fox, too, survives to hunt the suburbs. I recently watched one trot down a nearby street in daylight. Even wolves, extinct in Maine for a century, are padding down from Canada. One made it all the way to the coast before being snapped up by a trapper a few years ago. They're also moving toward the yards of Minnesota, Michigan, Montana, Idaho, and Washington. I'm fascinated by the possibility that wolves might decide they're just as comfortable among the bungalows as the coyotes and foxes are. It would be a curious circling back to the first meeting of tame dog and wild. Every canid that ever crossed my yard traces his ancestry to a pack of weaselly critters who climbed in trees about 60 million years ago. This new branch of mammals, called miacids, wanted a meatier diet than their predecessors enjoyed. When the dinosaurs died, the carnivore job was suddenly available. Miacids evolved big brains, which they needed to sneak up on prey, and big teeth for ripping open the meat packages. When the group divided about 50 million years ago, one branch turned doggish and the other turned cattish. The doggish branch split further. The ancestors of bears and seals, which have always reminded me of dogs, branched off, along with increasingly dog-like animals. Some 30 million years ago, a German shepherd, on dachshund legs, may have scuttled through my yard. It looked like a dog. At the time, my neighborhood was taking part in a global cool-down. 1,000 miles north of my lawn, a ribbon of tundra was easing southward. In this final ice age, what did the proto-dogs hunt? Maine has no useful fossils from that time, thanks to glaciers plowing them into the sea. But judging from backyards in other parts of the nation, my yard was home to mini horses, macro pigs, proto-camels, rhino-also-rans, mammoths and mastodons, and perhaps even bear-sized beavers and giant sloths. The shepherd dachshund charged about the neighborhood, catching bizarre animals for many millions of years before his line petered out. Umpteen more pre-dog species continued to evolve toward dogness. The model that finally succeeded was a fox from the North American Southwest. From him descended today's assortment of wolves, foxes, jackals, coyotes, as well as wild and domestic dogs. Most of this speciating took place outside of North America. The proto-wolf loped away to Asia early in the game. There he evolved into the gray wolf. In Asia, people eventually tamed the gray wolf. Then the wolf, the dog, and people all journeyed from Asia eastward, toward my yard. When nature's canine experiment began, that original fox-like critter could have skittered from my backyard to Greenland and Europe. But the opportunity to hop continents was ending. The continents were crawling apart, at about the speed my fingernails grow. Soon, North America would be connected to Asia and Europe only in the west, by the Bering Land Bridge. And that was prone to flooding as the sea level fluctuated. After the ice ages commenced 2 million years ago, a glacier often blocked our end of the bridge completely. Some 160 million years prior, my yard had been down by modern Australia, mashed against northern Africa. Dinosaurs romped in Maine, although my yard was probably too alpine for their liking. When North America and North Africa initially collided to form Pangaea, they plowed together the sea sediments that had separated them. Mountains rose. The roots of those long eroded peaks are still visible a couple of blocks downhill from my yard, at Willard Beach. The folded, crushed layers of old seabed today form ragged ledges. Mine wasn't the only yard altered by its Pangaea experience, of course. At the Pangaea party, the backyards of the southeast waltzed with the western Sahara, which put the final touch on the Appalachian Mountains. Our subsequent departure from Pangaea tore a chunk of Africa away to become the backyards of Florida, southern Georgia, and coastal South Carolina. As North America backed away, it buckled the Pacific seafloor, giving a boost to the Rocky Mountains, which at the time formed the West Coast. The backyards of the current West Coast were manufactured as the Pacific Plate continued to collide with North America. It wasn't until the time of the dino die-off, 65 million years ago, that North America began to resemble its current self. An inland sea drained from the Great Plains of Canada and the United States. The widening Atlantic opened new arms, separating North America, Greenland, and Europe. After that, North America was often isolated. It was practically yesterday that real wolves cantered into North America from Asia. Just a few 100,000 years ago, the ancestor of the gray wolf made his debut in my yard. Well, he did if the ice didn't get there first. Glaciers have been a recurring problem in my yard, and one was on the way at that time. What a feast of fantastic creatures awaited this new wolf! He, along with the local saber-toothed cats, lions, coyotes, and the enormous dire wolf who evolved in the Americas, must have left a heap of strange bones in my yard. Imagine the wealth of fossils. Then imagine them 100 miles offshore, where the glaciers dumped them, probably after pulverizing them to fossil powder. The wolf and dire wolf, who bore the heavy jaws of a bone-cracking scavenger, may have leapt into my neighborhood between ice ages, just 125,000 years ago. The sheet of ice that has mashed my yard for most of the last 2 million years had shrunk toward the pole. At that moment, my particular lawn was beneath the Atlantic, which was swollen with the water of melted ice caps. The higher hills of the neighborhood were covered with forest. The wolf may have run down ancestors of today's rabbits and woodchucks, and even the forebears of my cheeky chipmunk. The dire wolf, similar in size to the modern gray wolf, might have gnawed lion bones in the woods or scrounged dead fish from the shore, which would have been at the top of my street. Perhaps to cool off, he dog-paddled over my yard. But the ice soon rolled back down. A snowbank a mile deep scraped over bedrock toward my lawn, plowing up soil and boulders. As the sheet expanded, the sea starved. It was donating snow to the glaciers, but the glaciers weren't generating rivers to refill the ocean. The ice swelled, and the Atlantic receded. Long before the glacier arrived on my lawn, cold winds poured off the looming ice and chilled the ground. One year, the acorns from the neighborhood oak trees never warmed enough to germinate. A few decades later, the glacier's speed can only be guessed, frost crystals bit so deeply into the oak twigs that the oak cells were rent. The following spring, the insect who laid her eggs on an oak doomed her offspring to starvation. The tree would not leaf out. Maybe a few hundred years later, scrappy conifers were the only trees still able to wring a living from my cold yard. Tundra grasses now found it hospitable. One spring, the frost never came out of the ground. As the tundra plants fled to Connecticut, the beetles and lemmings who ate those plants fled with them. The foxes who pounced on the lemmings followed their dinner. The dire wolf drifted south, too. My yard grew quiet, except for the swish of the wind over the frozen ground. Then the ice came. Over in Portland, it crawled up one side of the peninsula and rushed down the other. The snout of the ice was filthy with plowed earth and accumulated dust. Its shell was brittle and cracked. The rolling ice bank crossed Portland Harbor and rumbled up Willard Beach, wrenching out cubes of the bedrock and dragging them along. Up the hill it came. The ice plowed my yard to the bedrock and continued southward, clear to the continent's edge, 250 miles offshore. On the bedrock, it left nothing but tracks. I bundle up and walk to Willard Beach to track the glacier. The wind lately is feeling a bit glacial against the skin. At the ocean I hear the unfamiliar voices of the beach crows, my clan's northern neighbors. Like my crows, these are only around during daylight now. Each late afternoon, they join puddles and rivers of crows that flow from all directions toward Portland's Deering Oaks Park, which they've chosen for their winter rookery. The park trees fill with 1,000 crows as the sun dims. The streetlights blink on. Mornings, my crows come home spattered in the white excrement of their bedfellows. Here at the beach, the local crows are pulling dead fish and crabs from the seaweed. Like my crows, they can tell when they're being watched, and they don't appreciate it. I keep my eyes on the rocks. When the glacier came through in the last ice age, boulders and rocks embedded in the ice acted like giant sandpaper against the old folded rocks. I don't have to look far to find their scratches on the exposed ledge. This outcrop is a worn-down fold of sedimentary rock dating to the Maine-Africa collision. The layers now stand on edge. Most stripes are the color of graphite, but ribbons of quartz intervene. When I face south, the low autumn sunlight throws shadows into grooves on the rock. Most of them could be mistaken for marks left by a pebble stuck in the tread of a boot, but there are too many, and they're all scratching in the same direction, and some of them are a half inch wide. That would be a big pebble. On hands and knees, I crawl along a shelf of rock, tracking individual pebbles and the motion of the ice that pressed them into the ledge. Pseudoscientist that I am, I'm worried that my glacial striations may have been made by pebbles in boots. I survey the whole ledge. Crawling on, I find striations on the corners of little cliffs where people couldn't walk. More scratches emerge from under soil. Okay, I'm convinced. But now I found a small patch of folded rocks peeking out of the sod. Through it runs a vein of quartz tinted with iron that has oxidized. Garnet? I think so. A second quartz layer is exposed to the elements, and its softest minerals have dissolved out, leaving an open matrix of crystals. Gorgeous. I crawl on. Every crystal tells a tale. Continents rove. Glaciers rumble. Dire wolves flee. The sun dims. The crows rise to the trees, then rise again and head for Deering Oaks. I rise too and run for home. Every backyard in North America shivered when the ice came south. The white wall crunched over New England and New York. It overwhelmed the Great Lakes and grated across Ohio. From Manitoba, it rolled over the Dakotas and Minnesota. It mashed Bismarck and Seattle. When the ice stalled 18,000 years ago, it was flanked by a ribbon of tundra that ran through the Midwest and Pennsylvania. South of that, most of the continent's backyards grew a winter coat of frost-worthy pine and spruce. Just how the camels and sloths and dire wolves felt about the chill is a subject of debate. They all disappeared as the ice finally waned. But whether their dietary needs couldn't keep up with the changing plants, or whether a new predator and his dog ate them all, only time and research can tell. Whatever the case, man and dog did walk into North America near the end of the last ice age, and things would never be the same. Perhaps that's not saying much, considering how dramatically the glaciers were rearranging things. Even as people from Asia fanned across North America, ice continued to renovate my yard. When the ice advanced, it plowed the bedrock clean. Then as it melted, it dropped all the boulders, gravel, and sand it had carried. To see the before and after, I unfold two geology maps. On the bedrock map of Maine, I can make out the roots of the old Alps, now hidden under my backyard soil. The layered rocks were folded into ridges, then erosion and glaciers grated off the ridgetops. What's left is a corduroy of different aged layers tilted on edge. To see what the melting glacier dropped atop my bedrock, I turn to the surface geology map. Gray bedrock pokes through the glacial junk in only a few spots. Acadia National Park is a mound of bedrock on the mid-coast. The White Mountains form gray stepping stones to Mount Katahdin, a mass of granite at mid-state. But the majority of Maine is pale green till. That's a jumble of sand, silt, clay, and stones, which may, the map legend notes, contain many boulders. Maine farmers would agree, till is no fun to till, but it does make for picturesque stone walls. And my yard on the map is pale gray for glacio-marine deposits. My lawn's last dunking dates to 14,000 years ago. The advancing glacier had pressed the yard into the earth's molten basement, and when the ice retreated, the sea swamped the depressed land. The Atlantic overran Willard Beach, sloshed up the slope, and pushed halfway through the state. But you can't keep a good continent down. The crust rebounded so fast that by 9,000 years ago, the ocean had drained 15 miles offshore from the current beach. It left behind mud flats, spreading like frosting over the lumpy till. This blue clay, studded with shells and worm fossils, turns up in backyards and gardens all over the southeastern third of the state. In my neighbor's new cellar hole, it lies under 3 feet of sand that were probably laid down when the ocean was retreating. After both ice and ocean cleared out of my yard, the southbound flow of life reversed. Tundra lichens and dwarf willows marched back to colonize the cold till. Blowing dust, plus dead plants and the corpses of their faithful insects, enriched the sand. Spruce trees caught this soil and thickened it with their needles and dead wood. Squirrels fed on the cones. Modern gray wolves twanged the tendons of caribou in my yard while the air grew warmer. Over on the west coast, the Bering Land Bridge was passable and populated with grazing animals. Two new species, man and dog, ate their way across the bridge, then poked their noses into the backyards of North America. Is it a coincidence that a bevy of beasts promptly went extinct? The American mammoths and mastodons, camels and giant beavers, had evolved on a people-free continent. Their instincts may not have been honed against such a brainy predator. Some scientists contend that the yo-yo of climate change was more injurious because it shifted plants up and down the latitudes too quickly for grazing animals to adapt. Whether North America's large mammals starved or fed the newcomers, they died out at about the same time that dogs and their people swept through the Americas. And that's all we have time for on this edition of The Maine Reader. We're reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. This is The Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.